Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Jonathan Tropper, whose latest novel is This Is Where I Leave You, earlier novels, Plan B, a novel, The Book of Joe, Everything Changes, and more recently, How to Talk to a Widower. In Hollywood, he's just written a screenplay for Harvey, which is going to be directed by Steven Spielberg, and we will talk about that in a little bit. But first, This Is Where I Leave You is a rarity in that it's a comic novel, and these days there aren't that many comic novels out there, novels that make you laugh out loud. Was that your intent when you were going in? I mean, this novel is very, very funny.
It was not my intent. I mean, it wasn't my intention to not be funny. All of my books encompass, you know, a certain level of humor as I write them because I want them to be entertaining. But I generally try to grapple with some serious topics while I'm doing it. So it's kind of like a spoonful of sugar to help the medicine go down. I try to, you know, be funny while I'm dealing with rather serious issues.
Well, the reason I say that is that I was reading it. I kept thinking, and it's never been mentioned, you've been compared to people like Nick Hornby, but I kept thinking Neil Simon.
I've not heard Neil Simon. This book lends itself to that comparison, but because it's a family sitting together for 7 days, there is that feeling of a stage play, that, you know, the kind of writing Neil Simon would do in Rumors, where everything takes place in one living room, which isn't really the case in the book, but it does feel that way, so I understand that.
When you were working on it, were you thinking in terms that, hey, this could be a stage play or a screenplay, or was that just something not?
Actually, because a number of my books have been optioned, I actually set out with each book with the express intention of writing it in a way that nobody will see how to option it. And that didn't work out with this book. They ended up optioning it anyway. But I really try to stay away from thinking about film or stage when I'm writing a novel.
Jonathan Tropper, let's get into This Is Where I Leave You, because, as you say, it's very funny, but it's got some very serious themes. It's the story of a man whose life is falling apart, whose dad dies. His dad was a non-practicing Jew who apparently, as a last request, wanted his family to sit shiva, which means sitting down for a week with his family on hard stools, being unable to pretty much leave during the day and deal with one another for 7 days. The idea of sitting shiva with a dysfunctional family, how did that come to you? Did someone die and you just saw what could happen?
I've been to quite a few shiva homes. I've never sat shiva myself, but I do come from a Jewish community in New York, and I have been to a lot of shiva houses, and everyone is different. Sometimes, you know, depending on who's passed away and depending on the nature of the family, some of them feel like parties and some of them feel like funerals and everything in between, and the atmosphere is always different. But, you know, it occurred to me that a family that isn't close, that is forced into this kind of proximity for 7 days, if they had issues with each other, it's kind of like a natural pressure cooker. You're just putting all these volatile molecules into a sealed environment and letting them bounce off each other for 7 days. It just seemed like a great structure for a book.
Well, how did you come to that idea? Where did it come from?
Well, originally I didn't have that idea. Originally I was writing a book about Judd Foxman, who's lost his wife and his job on the same day, basically because his wife was sleeping with his boss. And I was going to, you know, write a book about this man who's been stripped of everything that he felt made him who he was, and his journey, you know, back towards some semblance of a life that he felt good about. It's about 100 pages in, I decided that an important journey for him would be going home to visit his nuclear family with whom he has all these issues as sort of this beaten and cuckolded man. And when he got home, the chapter I wrote where he meets his siblings again, whom he hasn't seen for a while, the characters just came alive for me in a way that they hadn't when I was writing the first 100 pages of the book, and I decided to throw out a good chunk of the beginning of the book and make it a book about Judd Foxman going home. And then I just needed a device to keep him home. And I said, what keeps someone home long enough? You know, why would he stay if he hates these siblings so much? And so I came up with the idea that he's staying to sit shiva because that's the only reason he would stay.
And portions of that first 100 pages wound up as flashbacks, I would guess.
Well, the whole part about him and his marriage and all of that stayed in the book. But everything else is gone.
Judd himself is, if you think about it, a pretty unpleasant character, which means you're writing from the point of view of someone who you may not particularly like. I mean, he's very funny and very witty, but
he's nasty. What I tried to do with this book was, and I had tried this once before, years ago I wrote a book called The Book of Joe, and I had written a similarly nasty character, and the publisher had pressured me to make him a little more sympathetic. And I did that. It was my second novel, and I was very susceptible to publisher pressure. this time around, I had a publisher who really gave me the freedom to write the way I wanted to. And I wanted to write about a guy who was angry at the world, whose life had really turned around on him, and his life had fallen apart in a heartbeat. One minute he thought everything was fine, and the next minute he had nowhere to live, he had no wife, and he had no job. He's angry. The fact that he finds out his wife has been sleeping with another man for the last year brings into question his manhood, and he's having all sorts of issues about his own manhood, and this is a guy who's lashing out at the world now as he tries to figure himself out.
His voice itself, how easy or hard was that to create it, or did it kind of come full-blown into your head?
It wasn't that hard for me. I think his voice is very similar to my worst mood. And I just had to channel my worst mood for, 350 pages. But I just let him say things that I would never say out loud, and I let him think things that I would never share with anybody. But he's, he's not that unrealistic.
The other characters, the other family members, he has a mother who wrote books about dealing with children, and he and his siblings were characters in the book. I don't remember who I interviewed, but someone I know actually was that example, and it was awful.
Yeah, I mean, Judd's mother, it's very ironic. She's sort of the Dr. Spock of her generation, and she's written these books about, the psychology of child rearing and all her ideas about how to raise your children. And meanwhile, she's raised a group of children who can't even function together. But as kids, they were humiliated because she cited the examples of her own children in her books. And so they had friends who could dig up her books and see how it was when they were being toilet trained. And it was a source of humiliation to them when they were growing up.
Was she based on anybody, or did that just come full blown?
No, that was just made up.
He's got a sister named Wendy, whose husband, Barry, seems to me, in an interview you gave, you talked about the hedge fund people in Westchester, and he's a perfect example, I guess, of one of your neighbors.
He's a perfect example of most of my neighbors. Yeah, he's just this finance guy who's so wrapped up in his work that he can never look away from his BlackBerry, never get off the cell phone. And even at a time when his family's in crisis, when his wife has lost her father, he's sitting there on the way to the cemetery taking calls, at the funeral checking his BlackBerry. He's constantly involved in his deals. And it's just a phenomenon I've noticed I live in an area where a lot of people are in finance. And because of the culture of the financial institutions, they just feel that their job trumps everything.
Well, the character reminded me a lot of the character Jeff Daniels plays in God of Carnage, but of course you couldn't have known that.
Right. Somebody recommended I see God of Carnage. I haven't seen it.
Jonathan Tropper, the other characters include a younger brother named Philip, and the sense I got with Philip, he's kind of a ne'er-do-well who's trying desperately to come into his own, is that at the beginning, it seems like you're expecting to dislike him, but he actually becomes the most likable member of the family, and that seemed like a transition that must have just happened.
Yeah, I didn't plan it that way. I wanted Philip to really – Philip is the rascal of the family. He's 9 years younger than everybody else. He's in his 20s. He's very good-looking. He's had problems with drugs. He's never held down a job. He's not good in a relationship. He has too many women in his life. I originally introduced him, and I wanted him to be a fairly unredeemable character. But as I wrote the story, his relationship with Judd became central, and the friendship and the brotherly relationship he has with Judd started to click for me. And at that point, I wanted to see Philip trying to make good a little bit. And, even though by the end of the book he hasn't turned his life around, by any stretch, you do get the sense he'll keep trying to do that.
And there's an older brother named Paul who's going through issues that he kind of deals with in this. At what point did the entire Paul arc come about? Was it there when you introduced them, or was it something that kind of grew again and then you planted material early on?
Yeah, that happens a lot. That's actually a very insightful question. You don't start out fully understanding your characters. Certainly I don't. I understand my protagonist, and I have a rough idea of who the people he interacts will be, but only once you start writing it do you kind of see what you're missing or what presents itself. So I knew Paul was going to be the oldest brother. I knew he was going to have issues with his younger siblings, primarily because he was the guy who stuck around to run the family business with their dad while the rest of them ran off to live their lives. So he was going to have issues with Judd about that. And he was also in the midst of trying to have a baby with his wife, who was once Judd's girlfriend, and he was going to have issues about trying to become a father. But, in the first half of the book, you see that Paul really dislikes Judd. And I didn't have a full reason. I understood there was resentment, but why did he dislike him so much? And gradually it came to me that he blamed Judd for his life not having taken off the way it was supposed to. And that's when I came up with the idea that, you know, back in high school, Paul had defended Judd from a fight and had ended up getting injured in a way that ended his college baseball career, which, you know, changed the whole trajectory of his life.
Then you take all these people and throw them in a mix and then throw in the ex-wife coming back with her news and throw in this crazed shock jock that she's having sex with. At that point, do you know where it's going? You just kind of write feverishly and hope that at a certain point you'll be able to edit it?
I always know where I want my characters to end, and I always know how I'm going to start. Sometimes the plot in the middle doesn't present itself until I've gotten into it, and occasionally I have to make a drastic change in the middle. But I always knew where I wanted Judd to end up. I always knew where I wanted all of the siblings to end up by the end of the novel.
Jonathan Tropper, in reading about the earlier books, it seems that each book becomes slightly deeper than the previous one. It's like you started with a surface and you're digging much deeper. I guess that just happens, but there must be a certain conscious element of that as well.
What I'm trying to do consciously is not write the same book twice. And what I'm also trying to do is, as I grow, I'm trying to incorporate more of what I've learned in my life into my books in terms of characters and people and the trials that we go through. If you discount my first book, which is really the first book, Plan B, which was really more of a fantasy, and I call that my Get an Agent book, that book has significantly less emotional honesty, I think, than the other books. You know, I'm always writing about guys who are roughly my age who are figuring out at a certain point in life that their life is not what it was supposed to be, or that they've somehow fooled themselves into living the wrong life. But as I go with each book, I try to really work on the writing, and I try to develop the writing a little better, and I try to develop a deeper and more honest look at what a man is really thinking at these stages in his life.
Are you reaching a point where you're going to start throwing the jokes out in order to get that depth, you think?
You know, I don't mean to throw the jokes in. I think that's just the way I write. And when you're writing in a voice, you know, it is my intention that the reader be as entertained as they are enlightened. So I don't imagine I'll ever start writing, you know, very sort of dry literary fiction. It could be that I'll develop a voice. You know, there's a character I'm thinking about now for my next book who may not be quite as witty or as sardonic as these guys, but I think there will always be an element of humor in my writing.
All of your books, as you say, deal with 30-something men and their difficulties, which is an area we don't hear. It's like the Gen Xers are finally, in a way, coming into their own. It's kind of a silent generation. Why do you think that is?
What I've learned, you know, just from being out in the marketplace for the last 10 years is that there are very few men writers who are writing about this. That's why I'm constantly compared to Nick Hornby and Tom Perata. It's not because we write in a similar style. It's because there aren't that many of us who are writing about these topics. A lot of men, you know, are either writing very edgy literary fiction or they're writing genre fiction. But there aren't that many men, whereas there are many women who write about, you know, the family life of women, the relationship cycles of women. You know, as a result, I think it's underrepresented in modern literature.
Because I know Philip Roth was focusing on that when he was younger. So was John Updike. Do you think that the concerns have changed that much in those 30 or 40 years?
I think what's different is if you look at Updike's work and you look at Philip Roth, their men were more men. They were more like men. And the men we write about today are more like Arrested Development adolescents. I think the way society has changed for men is that men no longer just become men. They hold on to the boy that they were. You know, we're all obsessed with staying younger, not just physically, but men stay younger now emotionally too. And as a result, the men I'm writing about, I think, are coming to terms with things later in life than they should have, and coming of age later in life than they should have, whereas those guys, you know, they were dealing with issues of sexuality and marriage and wealth, but they had become men already to some extent. I mean, that's how I feel about it.
Well, in looking at your book, it would appear that putting aside the mother, Hillary, because she's her own world, the characters of the sister Wendy, Philip's older girlfriend Tracy, as well as another character, Penny, these people are more mature than any of the men.
Yeah. I don't know if that's just my own personal bias, but I do find that certainly myself and the men I know, we have either missed parts of coming of age or we're just doing it at later points. whereas the women around us tend to be a little more on the ball in terms of self-awareness and who they are and who they want to be.
Well, I look at the latest crop of Hollywood stars who are moving toward 50, and they're still boys, Johnny Depp or Brad Pitt or Tom Cruise.
Right. You look at them, they're flying airplanes and they're running around, and even though they're responsible fathers and professionals, they still race cars and, you know, whatever it is they do. They have not put boyish things aside. I'm not passing judgment on that. I'm not saying they should. But it's clear that we don't view coming of age the way it used to be.
You're listening to an interview with Jonathan Tropper, whose latest novel is This Is Where I Leave You. This Is Where I Leave You was set in the current time. There's mention of the recession, music of the time, some other topical areas. Very little politics. In fact, no one talks politics at all. Is that deliberate?
Yeah, I'm trying to keep that out of my work for now anyway. I've never been that interested in proselytizing or sharing my own politics, and I don't like putting it into my characters. I do think the time will come where I'll probably will have a character who has a political bent. I've always tried to really keep that out of my writing. I'm really trying to write just about the emotional truths of people, and I just never found a place for it in the books yet.
Well, it seems that now that we've entered a somewhat different era, the pressure is in a way off as well.
I guess, yeah, because everyone's sort of still waiting to see what's going to be. No one has really formulated terribly firm opinions yet on this administration or on the direction the country's headed. We're all just kind of watching to see how it plays out.
There is a subtext sitting in This Is Where I Leave You, and I don't know how conscious it is, but it's about growing older, the fear of growing older. Judd's observations of older people are extremely cruel.
Yeah, I think that subtext is there deliberately. I think that I'm no different than anybody else who considers that, and I'm 39 years old now, and so I'm in that place where I can still look back but look forward and see what's waiting for me. I don't think Judd's observations are meant to be cruel. I think they're meant to be harsh and brutal, because he's at a point of his life. It's much easier to grow older and to accept all of those negatives that come with growing older if you feel your life is amounting to something. He's just reached a point where he's 35 years old and he's lost everything, and now he knows he's going to keep getting older and he's starting from scratch again, and he's terrified of growing old without any of the things that are supposed to comfort you as you get older, you know, family, professional success, friends, you know, any kind of meaningful life. So yeah, he's become fixated on the physical manifestations of the older people he sees around him because he feels like he's heading there much too fast.
He's upset about what his mother will wear. He's upset about anyone older who has sexual feelings. It's really overwhelming.
He has this mother, this mother who had a very, you know, outspoken way of dealing with sexuality, and the fact that, you know, he has a 65-year-old mother who has these new breast implants and who dresses in revealing clothing, you know, I think most men aren't really interested in seeing their mothers as sexual objects, and that definitely troubles him.
Well, the rest of it with these people looking up their skirts.
Yeah. Well, that's just sort of a comment on sort of how Shiva works. When you sit Shiva, you sit on these very low chairs, and all of these visitors come to see you, and they sit on regular chairs so that your angle is looking upward, and it's summertime, so he's seeing, you know, a lot of very ugly feet and calcified nails and varicose veins, and, you know, it's where his point of view is, both metaphorically and physically.
There's some other stuff that I've never seen in books, but I know people express them in their heads, where there's one point where he's driving along and he falls in love four times along the way, creates entire scenarios for these women, and people I know do that, and yet I haven't seen that in books.
Yeah, I wanted to put that in there. First of all, I can't tell you how many men have commented to me on that part of the book and how true it is. But what's interesting is you might assume a guy like Judd drives along, sees a pretty girl, and has a sexual fantasy. But his fantasies aren't sexual. His fantasies are that these women, in the instant he sees them, he pictures an entire life with them. And it's not about Judd being horny. It's about Judd being lonely and Judd really craving a partner for the rest of his life.
But that's exactly what those fantasies are. They're not necessarily sexual.
Right. And so I wanted to get that down in the book, where we're not just leering there. We're not just leches looking at breasts and asses, even though we do that too. But really, you know, he's looking for a home. He's looking for a woman who will love him.
Jonathan Tropper, let's talk a little about your life. I've looked up your bio, and there's virtually nothing there. You were born in 1970. Yeah. Did you grow up in New York?
I grew up in New York. I was born and raised in New York, in Riverdale, New York, which is a suburb of New York. It's in the Bronx. I was never interested in putting too much of my personal life out there, but it was a pretty – if it had been a little more interesting, I'd probably – find a way to do it, but it was a pretty standard upper middle class upbringing. Nothing terribly exciting ever happened to me. That's probably why I write books about so many screwed up people.
Well, Riverdale itself is a very strange anomaly, because the rest of the Bronx, at least when you were growing up, was a pit, and yet somewhere there on the left,
the Hudson,
is this gorgeous little suburb that just somehow sits there.
Yeah, and it has survived, and it has endured, and it's thriving. And, you know, you can't really explain that. I always say, because now I live further north of Riverdale, that Riverdale is the worst of both worlds, because it's not quite suburbia, but it's not quite countrified Westchester. It's sort of this strange mix of apartment buildings and then enclaves of beautiful houses that wouldn't be out of place, you know, in the best neighborhoods of Beverly Hills. And, you know, there's lousy shopping because no decent place, can afford the rent there. I think Riverdale's just got their first Starbucks. They never even had a Starbucks. They don't have a Gap. They never had malls. It's just sort of the middle of nowhere. It was a very nice place to grow up, and I had no sense at the time when I was growing up there that it was an anomaly. It just felt like a neighborhood.
Then you went to college there?
And I stayed in New York the whole time, and then I, you know, after I got married, I tried to stay in Manhattan, but the apartment got too small, and then we actually moved back to Riverdale for a little while, and then we bought a house north in Westchester.
And you went to college, became an English professor?
I'm not an English professor. I teach a writing course, but I don't have a PhD. I did do a master's at NYU in their lit and writing program, but I always get uncomfortable when people call me professor. I teach a writing workshop, and, you know, I have a brother who's a real professor who has a PhD, and I just don't feel I should be called a professor.
Well, how did you get involved in writing? Were you writing articles before you wrote your first novel?
I always wanted to write. I don't remember exactly when that started. I remember I spent a summer in summer camp once, and I had picked up The Stand by Stephen King. And I just remember that. I spent the whole summer reading that book. It was like 800 pages. I remember feeling afterwards like how exciting it must be to create a world like that and write a world. So for a while, I thought I was going to be a horror writer. And then the other writer who really inspired me at that point was Kurt Vonnegut, because you read his books and it seems effortless. He writes in these very small little mini chapters, and he writes in a very colloquial English, and you feel like, wow, I could do that. And of course, it's totally deceptive. There's tremendous art to what he does. But as a high school kid, I felt, wow, I could do this. And also, he seemed to have no rules about how to tell a story. He told the story any way he wanted to. So when I got to college, I began writing short stories and entering them in contests. But they were largely, I think, knockoffs of Kurt Vonnegut and Stephen King, and certainly not my own voice. At some point, I think right around the end of college, somebody gave me Bright Lights, Big City by Jay McInerney, and that just changed everything for me. First of all, I think the book is brilliant. I think the way he writes, his economy, the fact that that novel is just about 200 pages. And if I wrote that novel, it would have to be 400 pages. But you don't feel you read a slight novel. Every word counts. Every sentence counts. And the idea that he could basically tell a story that almost isn't a story. It's just about the downward spiral of this kid living in New York and his downward cocaine spiral, his mother dying, and make it so compelling and make it feel like you were really reading a book about your own experience. I realized you don't have to write books about vampires, and you don't have to write books about grand themes. You could just tell a story in an honest voice and in a compelling way and make it work. And that really opened up my eyes to contemporary fiction.
And then at that point, you started work on Plan B?
That made me want to go to keep writing. I went to grad school. I got into the NYU writing program, and I was surrounded by other people trying to write. And I wrote, you know, stories and pieces there. And when I actually finished NYU, I wrote another novel, which I tried to sell, but it didn't go anywhere. Then I put it down for a few years, and then at some point I decided to try again, and I had the idea for Plan B, and I wrote that in about 8 months. It's the shortest time it ever took me to write a book.
But, and was it easy to get an agent?
It wasn't easy, but it happened, I think, faster for me than I would have expected. I finished the novel. I sent out probably about 40 query letters and synopses, and in those days you still had to mostly do it by snail mail, even though there was email was just taking off then. This was 1990, probably 1997, 1998, the agency still wanted paper submissions of a query letter with a self-addressed stamped envelope. You'd mail out about 50 queries, and then you'd get used to every day seeing your handwriting on the mail coming back with the rejections. And I grew to hate the sight of my own handwriting. But out of all of those query letters, I got two or three agencies that expressed interest, and then I sent out the manuscript. And of those, two offered to represent me.
Well, it seems to me that for young writers, the main thing is not give up, even if you're rejected on your first one or two novels.
What I tell everybody is, all things being equal, I think the difference between people who are published and people who aren't is the ones that kept sending out, the ones that kept submitting, and possibly revising as well. But certainly you keep submitting because there's such an element of serendipity to it. The way my agent found my letter was I sent it to another agent at his agency, and she wasn't interested, and she put it in a pile on her desk. He happened to come in that day to ask her a question, and she was on the phone. He sat at her desk waiting for her to get off the phone. He flipped through her pile, and he liked my letter. So if he had walked in an hour later, maybe she'd have already thrown it out, and I wouldn't have got, you know, it's all, there is a tremendous element of serendipity to it, and you have to just have your stuff out there as much as possible to give luck a chance to find you.
You're also lucky in the sense that these days most writers, they have to hit a home run first time out or they're screwed, and yet you've got the standard older version of the career
slow
arc.
Build.
Yeah,
it never really occurred to me. You know, of course I fantasize that each book would hit a stride and but it's been actually a very slow build for me. Each book has been a slightly slower build. It's harder when you're not writing genre fiction. I don't write the kind of books that jump onto the bestseller list. I write character-driven personal novels, and fiction-wise, it's not the easiest sell. So it has been a slow build for me, and I think there are writers that are – it can still work that way for writers, but, yeah, publishers are becoming much more choosy about what they'll publish, and if a first book doesn't work, it does become harder to get them to invest in marketing a second one.
Then you wind up getting great reviews in places like Entertainment Weekly.
You know, I've been in Entertainment Weekly twice before, but I was always in the books in brief section. This book finally, for me, has hit all the places I always wanted to hit. I got the full page review in Entertainment Weekly. I got the full column in the New York Times, USA Today, you know, a lot of the regional papers. This publisher has really worked hard to make everyone pay attention to this book, and it's actually very gratifying to me.
Well, before we get on to a little bit of your Hollywood story, you said earlier on that you switched publishers. And off the air, you said it was because they wanted to market you as kind of like a male chick lit book. How did that work, switching publishers? What's the story behind that?
I was getting a little frustrated because my books were not breaking through this. I had a decent amount of readers, but my books were just not getting the readership I wanted. Yet in Europe, I was a bestseller. I was a bestseller in Germany, France, and England. And with the same book in my own home country, the word was just not getting out in a way that I felt it ought to. So after my last book, How to Talk to a Widower, became a bestseller in three other countries and did not do significantly better than my previous book in the States, I felt that I just needed somebody who was going to introduce me in a different way. And so I owed my publisher one more book on my contract, and my agent and I negotiated that I would give them back the advance and take it out to the marketplace. And they were actually very gracious about it. I think they shared my frustration. You know, they had certainly tried their best, but I think at some point you just need somebody with a fresh perspective to do it. And if you look at this book compared to those other books, there's a whole different look to the book. There's a whole different feel to the way it was introduced to the market. And I think it just needed some new blood.
I get the feeling that now at least you can begin to be marketed. Yes, you're a funny writer, but as a literary writer, a serious writer.
Yeah, and I'm certainly not looking to be taken as seriously as some of the giants. But I think what I'm writing is smart fiction, and I don't want it to be marketed as sort of disposable comical fiction. And I write about serious issues, and I try to write in a really truthful manner about what men are going through. And, you know, I just want the book to reflect that, and I want the package to reflect that. I don't want it to look like a disposable comic novel.
So your next book will be a Stephen King vampire novel, eh?
No, at some point I may go down that road, but it will be a very sort of suburb-based man in conflict vampire novel.
Well, let's talk about Hollywood. I mean, you've had a couple of options on How to Talk to a Widower, I believe, and Everything Changes is already in pre-production then?
No, it's not. Nothing's in pre-production yet. Everything Changes, it has a script written by Peter Hedges, who's a writer I really admire. He's on board to direct it, and they have Tobey Maguire on board to produce it. I'm not sure. I'm not really involved in the process. I know they're still waiting for certain things to align so that they can get the movie going, but they're pretty passionate about the project, and I'm hopeful that they'll get it made at some point.
And How to Talk to
a Widower? How to Talk to a Widower is at Paramount, and they have a script written by Scott Frank, who's one of really the top screenwriters out there. And he's also on board to direct that, and I believe they are having casting issues. And, you know, right now in Hollywood, nobody's moving forward on anything without a cast that everyone can agree on. They have not come to agreement yet on who could star in that. So, I'm hopeful that project also will eventually get moving.
Well, the story of Harvey now, it sounds as if you might have just been writing a screenplay on spec. Is that what happened?
I was hired. I had been doing some work as a screenwriter, and I wanted to really get involved in screenwriting. So I went out to L.A. a year ago, and my agent set up a number of meetings at studios. And I had a handful of fans out there who had tried to option my books but had been outbid, but people who were willing to entertain the idea of me as a screenwriter. And Fox 2000 had this project of Harvey. When they described the project to me, it really appealed to me. It is not a remake of the Jimmy Stewart film. They have the rights to the original 1945 play, and they wanted a completely new adaptation of that play. They didn't want a remake of the movie, so I didn't even watch the movie. I stayed away from the movie, and I just read the play, and I worked off of the play, and I was lucky that they hired me because I know they were looking at bigger screenwriters and certainly screenwriters with more credits than me, but they gave me a shot, and I suppose it helped that I was cheap. I spent 3 months doing nothing but write that script. I spent a lot of time on that script. And I wrote a very contemporary movie. I'm sure it will bear little, if any, relationship to the film from 1950.
We're not going to see a CGI Harvey.
There's certainly not one in the script. But, you know, the writer in Hollywood is really, once you've done your part, you're not really part of the process that much. You know, I'll do some rewrites, I'm sure, but then it's up to the director and the producers to guide the movie that way.
As someone who loves the movie, yeah. You know, and has seen a version of the play, yeah. Do we really need another version?
From reading the play, there was a story I wanted to tell that had to do with definitions of what sanity is and conformity at what price. To me, the play was also really about how suspicious we've become about, you know, when it comes to people who are being genuinely kind, how suspicious we are of kindness, how as a society we've evolved to the point where we're suspicious of altruism and we're suspicious of kindness. And the play is about a guy who's just the nicest guy in the neighborhood, and people don't know what to make of that. And that's almost weirder than the fact that he sees an invisible rabbit, is the fact that he's such a nice and kind person. And I thought there were a lot of things to write about today's society based on that. And the fact that it happens to be based on Mary Chase's play, it grounded it in a literary tradition and possibly something that would also be easier to get it made.
Well, do you think the fact that Spielberg's attached to it maybe will preserve what sounds to me like, after thinking this may be the worst idea I've ever heard, it's making it sound like a good idea?
I think it's a very good idea. Look, I'm thrilled that he wants to direct it. I mean, that was never something I would have dreamed would happen. And I think that there's a great story to tell here, and he is, you know, one of our preeminent cinematic storytellers, so I don't think there's a lot to worry about there. I don't think it's going to offend purists, and I think it's just a different take on it.
What's the story of something called After Haley?
After Haley is the movie project of How to Talk to a Widower.
Okay.
When I wrote that book, it was called After Haley, and when we sold it to Paramount, it was called After Haley, and the publishers then changed the title to How to Talk to a Widower. But if there's a God, that movie will be called After Haley and not How to Talk to a Widower, which was not my idea for the book title.
Really? Yeah. Really? How did that happen? Was it the publisher just saying?
Yeah, I mean, this is the first book. This is Where I Leave You is the first book to make it to press with my original title.
Why did you choose this title?
This is going to sound really hokey, but we were struggling for a title, and I just woke up one morning and it was in my head. It just seemed like a great evocative title because there's so much leaving going on in this book. The dad has departed and left behind his dying request. Judd's wife has left him. This family has all left each other, and it just seemed like a very nice evocative title for that. What happened with How to Talk to a Widower is the sales force, they didn't love the title, and you need those guys behind the book. So in the book, he writes a column called How to Talk to a Widower, and they decided to make that the title. I didn't like it. I was worried the book would be seen as a self-help book and not as a novel, which has happened. It seems like a mouthful. It wouldn't have been my choice.
And somewhere I read that you're working on a television series.
I pitched two different series, and I've kind of learned why series don't get bought. And now I'm working with a good friend of mine and a great writer, David Schickler, and the two of us are actually developing another show that we'll take out there maybe next year.
Well, when you say you know how television series don't get bought, what do you mean?
I mean, I've learned when you pitch two, I pitch two very different shows over the course of about 3 years, and you meet with a lot of TV studios, and then you hear why they're not going to pick up the show, you kind of learn what they're looking for a little more and what the little red flags are that you shouldn't develop because no one's going to buy them. Cable has really opened up the marketplace in terms of the type of shows you can develop, but they're all very scared and the development has become much smaller. They're not developing the way they used to. Oh, let's try these 20 shows and if three stick, we're good. They're being much more selective about how many shows they'll develop. And there are a lot of things they worry about. They worry about what, you know, does this have multi-season levels or will this premise have played itself out after the first season? That's something you have to think about. Is there anything similar being developed out there, even remotely thematically similar? Because if so, we don't want to go down that road. So, you know, there's a lot of little things that can derail your pitch.
And if it makes it, what role would you play?
I would love to think that I would stay on as the head writer. I don't know.
Wouldn't that derail... I mean, it did derail George Pelicanos a bit when he was doing all the writing for The Wire.
Yeah, I certainly wouldn't do all the writing, and that's also the reason I'm doing it with a partner right now. It's the first time I've collaborated with someone. I think the goal would be sell the show, write the pilot. If the pilot gets picked up, you know, develop a team of writers and gradually fall back a little bit so I could continue writing books and screenplays, which is what I really want to do.
Jonathan Tropper, you have other screenplays out there then.
I've written an adaptation of my book, The Book of Joe, which we are in the process of showing. Everyone has liked it, but nobody has bought it, and I'm hoping that somebody would pick that up. And just this morning, I emailed in the first draft of the script of this book, This Is Where I Leave You, which I wrote for Warner Brothers.
And how did that go, just trying to transform it? Because I know people like the late Donald Westlake loved writing other people's books, but not his own.
Well, you know, I've watched a lot of people adapt my books, and it's a painful process, and I figured at least let me try it myself. The way I approach it is that as a novelist, I work alone. I write alone, and every word on the page is mine. No matter how we see the movie, no one's ever going to change the novel. So I'm willing to approach the same characters and story in a different way if it makes it palatable for a two-hour movie.
And finally, what are you working on now?
Now I am in the really painful process of starting a new novel. That's my primary objective. And at the same time, I'll probably be doing some rewrites on Harvey and some rewrites on the screenplay of This Is Where I Leave You. And at some point down the road, I'm going to look for another screenwriting project.
You've been listening to an interview with Jonathan Tropper, whose latest novel is This Is Where I Leave You. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.